Get you under the table. Don't spare the rod. Let's pray together before we start. Thank you, God, for allowing us together and to be in this comfortable place, to open your book and think about your son. And we ask you to help us understand him better in every facet of who he was. In Jesus' name, amen. So I mentioned early in the class that high school class parallels this class. So if you've got a kid or a grandkid in that class, the Wednesday before, they study whatever we study in here. So I asked the class last Wednesday, since we're at about, we are at the end of the first month, to go back and to tell me what you've seen about Jesus. Somebody's trying to break in the door. You just have to turn the handle. So I challenge the kids especially to try to set aside everything you've already learned about Jesus and just open the book and look at these episodes and see what it says to you, see what picture emerges. So I'd like to put the same question to you tonight to see if you can do as good as I did. What have you seen so far in the three classes we have had together about Jesus? What picture is emerging? Give me some pieces of it. Well, that doesn't make me feel good about my teaching. Sorry? So, one of the things we considered was this picture of him as the friend of sinners, the accusation that was leveled against him. He was the friend of sinners. Good. What other facets of the picture have emerged?
Sinners, he's to save.
Sorry?
It's to sinners, he's come to save.
Now, that was his crowd. That was what he argued. Who should I be with? And I've come to rescue the people that are lost. That's who I need to be going to.
I think the perception of the two different groups, like you got the Pharisees and the law, and then you got the sinners, and the perception of Jesus from the two different, if you compare them, it's like so different. So, like, you see him one way and I see him the other, which makes sense because, you know, they think they're already saved and good, but the sinners need Jesus and want Jesus, and they see him in a whole different light.
So I guess we shouldn't be surprised that people see him in very different ways today. There are accurate pictures and inaccurate pictures. Thank you. What else have we seen? What else has emerged? This was your class.
That he called out and judged.
Ah, thank you. There we go. Yeah, that he called out and judged people. I think he even chose that topic on your own. Is that different than the picture of him being the friend of sinners?
Well, yeah, because people like to throw around the judge knot like all the time, right? So the fact that he literally came to judge the right from wrong that people do.
I wrote in my notes that he was a straight shooter, okay? Does that language resonate with you guys? That he had no problem telling people that what you're doing is wrong. He did it in different ways because of different audiences, but he did it nonetheless. The woman caught in adultery in John 8, he still told her that she needed to quit sinning, right? So he was tough on the Pharisees in Matthew 23, but either way you go, he's still calling out sin. Did you want to know?
That was the exact example I was going to mention, was the woman caught in adultery, but beyond her, how he impacted the people who were there to stone her.
Yeah.
Because he asked a very interesting question to all of them that made them do a deeper search of their heart to determine, that they weren't in a position where they could place judgment on her because of their own sin. And he just did it with questions.
Yeah.
And he didn't get mad. He didn't, throw up his hands, and he just sat down and started writing on the ground.
So if you watch the class topics as we go through, I have tried to select contrasting topics. And so I think Jesus, the judger, the guy who calls people out, is really in pretty sharp contrast to Jesus, the friend of sinners. Do you buy that? It would almost seem like those wouldn't work together. Why? Or do you buy that? Maybe you don't buy that. How does the guy that's calling out sin become the friend of sinners?
Because he relates to the humanity of the individual.
Maybe so.
Okay. Because if he really loves them, he does. I mean, if you really love them, you don't want them to sin anymore.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. The reason I wanted you to ponder that is that sometimes knitting together an accurate picture of Jesus requires that we figure out how to put things together that don't seem to go together. And I think that is a very common problem in our culture, that people form inaccurate pictures of Jesus because they collect the pieces that they like or they're comfortable with. But when you encounter Jesus doing something and you think, okay, that doesn't fit the other things I've seen, sometimes we just kind of brush by that stuff. And that's going to be the case with what we'll look at tonight. So remember, last class we were talking about the friend of sinners. Now lay that up beside John 2 and verse 13. I'm going to read this, and I'm going to help you out since we didn't do a great job of giving me feedback initially. Let me tell you what's coming so you can kind of be stewing over it. I am going to begin every class by asking you, help me construct the picture. What are we seeing? So be pondering that. But tonight, I'm going to read this little piece from John 2. And I'm going to ask you when I'm done, how does this picture look like the other pictures we've seen, and how is it different from the other pictures? So, John 2, verse 13, the Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables. And he made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business. And his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. The Jews then said to him, what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. Let me pause there and ask you, how is this picture like other pictures we've seen? Is it similar in any way?
David, my mind just goes back to when he was just 12 years old. You know, where's my son? He's in the temple teaching. So from a young age, he realized his calling was to be about his Lord's business. And that place is about the Lord's business. It's not about anything else.
Okay.
And he has a gentle spirit, but you cross the line.
Okay. Thank you. How is it like other pictures we've seen?
Well, I will say this. He was premeditated in what he did here. It's very, very clear. He saw what he saw. He planned his response. He prepared for that response. And then he executed that response. He was very deliberate in what he did. It wasn't like I walked into the temple and I saw this and I blew up. It was very well calculated.
By the way, so let me make the other argument. Does it look like he did? I mean, when you read this, come on, are any of you uncomfortable with the story? I mean, does it just kind of make you go, was he having a bad day or what? What's that?
Especially when you compare it to how he acted when they were going to crucify him. Not a word. And now he's kind of seems like he's exploding.
Somebody doesn't look like the friend of sinners here, does he? He looks like he's mad.
I see it more as that parent that knows what's going on already, you know, and you're just waiting to catch him in the act. And then you have that, you know, you're about to get, you're making a point. So you go in there and you catch him in the act, and well, sometimes you mess up and they don't go in the act, but sometimes you're right and you see them in that act and you make it a point to let them know how mad you are. You already knew it was happening. You already knew it was coming. Because Jesus doesn't seem to me somebody to be caught off guard with anything. As cunning as he was with the Pharisees and being able to lead them into, you know, answering their own question, and either way they answered, they were wrong, or they were going to be in trouble either way. It doesn't seem to me the type of person that would go into something and, like, just be caught off guard. I think he knew. I think he went in with a purpose, and I think he served its purpose.
Now you sound like him.
I was more uncomfortable with the fig tree incident, where he curses the fig tree. Not that particular one. He was maintaining order in the temple.
Think so?
So what do you think?
Did you ask me the same thing 2 weeks ago?
Let's unpack that.
I think this looks like some of the other pictures we've seen, like Matthew 23, where he pretty brutally calls out the Pharisees. This was your class, how he rebukes people for their sin. But again, I think a lot of people would struggle to see how a guy turning over tables and flinging coins and driving cattle is the friend of sinners.
But why do we think that?
Well, now that's getting to the heart of the question, isn't it? I will tell you how far some people go in being disturbed by their study, this scene. There are people that deny that this story is authentic, that it doesn't belong in the Bible, that some random person threw it in, but it can't be an authentic story. And you know what their argument is?
They think Jesus sinned by getting angry.
It doesn't fit the other pictures. And so, remember, we looked at pictures when we started this class. Everyone likes Jesus gently looking over his sheep, having his watchful eye on them. In fact, what I should use is the picture of Jesus holding the lamb, right? Everybody likes that picture. How many refrigerators' door is that on, right? I have never seen the refrigerator door magnet that has Jesus waving a whip as he flips a table, right? With the caption, "Zeal for my house, my father's house consume me." Where is that? How come that's not on the fridge? But that's the argument. That's why people say, I don't think that story is authentic, because you can't put those two pictures together.
But they're both love.
I think that's right. Yes, sir.
I think it completes the picture of Jesus. Because he is God in the flesh, but he is a man, and he needs to show some force at some point in time. He can't just be this meek and mild. I think from a man perspective, at some point you need to be able to show some force that needs to be taken in an appropriate situation. And this was it. So they crossed the line, and enough's enough. It doesn't negate the fact that he is this lover of sinners who wants them to turn from their ways and be in the fold. It doesn't negate that at all. It just says, like a loving father, sometimes a loving father has to be stern. And there it is. I think without it, you would have an incomplete picture of Jesus.
Okay, thank you, Randy.
I was going to say, this is fairly tame when you look back in the Old Testament on how God dealt with the Israelites when they sinned.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because you're ahead of me, okay? Hold that thought. I'm coming back there. You're one step ahead, and that's exactly right.
But like I said, I mean, this was fairly tame. If you go look at some of those stories, and I'll let you make your point, but if you go look at those stories, this was pretty tame.
I think so.
And what's he supposed to do? Is he supposed to just go whisper in everyone's ear?
Yeah.
You know, hey, can you stop and move this outside?
I think
it's a pretty measured response for what was occurring.
Yeah, I think some people would say that even in this situation, they want the Jesus on the line. Oh my!
But it is, and it isn't
like a doting grandpa response,
right? Right, you're doting.
Okay, how many grandpas are in here? Hold on. How many grandpas are in here? Right? Let's see. How many grandpas? doting grandpa response. My grandchildren do not do anything wrong.
Absolutely.
Right? There are other people God put on earth to be mean to them.
They're the total sheep.
That is not me. I
am not. The Roman Reigns with the table.
And this is going out, son. It's on you, buddy. So that's how they want God to be. The doting grandpa who says, oh my, I wish you hadn't done that. And I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. No. No, but it is, like Brittany's saying, like it's a measured response because it's not like this is the first time they've ever done this and he walks in like, what's happening? Like, he knew they were doing this already. Like, this was in the occurrence. It was happening every week. So it was a measured response, which in my opinion, just my opinion, like negates the whole thing. Like, he came in full of rage and whatever. It wasn't like an off-the-cuff, like when we have an angry response to something. It wasn't like that because he walked in knowing exactly what he was going to find.
Okay.
So it wasn't an off-the-cuff, like, rage rack.
Yeah, y'all all covered
my lost control.
Yeah, y'all all covered my class, so y'all can just go and hang out. Because that's y'all are touching all the bases that I wanted to touch in here tonight. Now, let me say this, because I am kind of picking on this contrast, because I think it's important. I think it is a cop out to label one of the stories as not authentic, and I think it represents a larger cultural effort to dismiss parts of the Bible or reason away parts of the Bible that we don't like and we're uncomfortable with, right? There's no evidence that this account is not authentic. There's no textual issue there that makes us wonder. It's not like this wasn't until the late, didn't pop up till the late manuscripts. There's no reason to reject it. The only reason people want to reject it is why?
Because it fits their narrative of the peaceful, forgiving, full of grace.
This picture of Jesus, right? So we need to be careful about idolatry because that's what it is. When I make Jesus who I want him to be, or I take only the pieces that make a Jesus that I want, it's idolatry. I have to embrace him the way it is. So we have to work a little harder to figure out this Jesus, and you guys have already been tapping that, as we wrestle with his story. So here's a question I want to give you. Let's unpack this a little bit. And what I'd like you to do is to look back at the text and identify the pieces of the story that will help us understand what's happening here. Let's get into the tall grass of what's going on in this story, and you tell me, what pieces do you see that you say, this is important, this helps us understand the scene? What do you see?
In 14 and 15, first he finds them selling the oxen and the doves, and then he makes the scores and cords.
Okay.
So it's... He took his time putting that together because he was getting ready for what's about to come.
Okay.
So it wasn't off the cuff, like he just got upset. He took his time. He calculated where he was going.
Okay, good. Thank you. What other details do you see that are important to us understanding the scene that is before Jesus?
I think the fact that they're making money. I mean, he makes it a point to say the money changers. They are there making a profit in the church.
Okay.
I mean, if they were giving away the stuff to the needy or whatever, I think that would have been a different thing. But they're like making money. They're making a living in the church.
Okay, so you got something going on with money and coins there.
I think there's something even more fundamentally wrong with the story, and that is when people came to the temple to make their offering, there was preparation that was to take place before they came to the temple.
Okay.
This nullified all of that. I'll just pick up a pigeon when I walk into the temple, you know, and we'll be good there, you know.
I think there's a reason for that, though.
Okay.
And it's in the context. It's in verse 13. And I think 13 is an important piece to understanding the scene.
Yeah.
All right, whoa. Go up to that. Let's start with that because that's where the story begins. So, what is the significance of the fact that this is Passover?
People would not be able to bring an animal.
If
they're from out of town.
Passover is what? Jeff talked about this morning. And we didn't even collaborate on this. It was one of the feast days.
Right.
When people would come to Jerusalem. Like 12 people.
Thousands
and thousands. Think Central Texas tomorrow, okay? Thousands and thousands of people converging like on Fredericksburg. This is what's happening during the Passover, okay? So now we've got money and coins, and what's the other piece of that?
The changers.
The changers along with that, and then the other totally other thing.
Passover?
Sorry?
Did you say the Passover?
It's at the Passover, and so at the Passover, we got the guys dealing with the money.
Well, they're selling oxen.
We got cattle. Yeah, okay? So let's talk about this a little bit. Why do we have people selling cows, changing money at the Passover?
Don't you think that this is an example for us today? Now, I have been to churches that actually have bookstores and bookstores and restaurants and that kind of thing, and you're not supposed to do that. And don't you think this is an example?
Maybe. Can I punt to that till the end? Because I want to deal with some
Only if you remember.
I probably won't.
Yeah, I don't know.
But you're here to remind me.
We get to that.
Tell me, at Passover, why? Why is this stuff going on?
Because there's a new crowd to cater to.
There was a new crowd to cater to.
There's a lot of people to cater to.
Okay.
Lots of money to be made.
There's a demand.
Why? Sorry?
They had to have a sacrifice.
Oh.
So think if you had spent 2 weeks traveling from some far off place to come to Jerusalem for the Passover because you needed to offer a sacrifice.
Find a sacrifice.
Would you have wanted to drag an oxen along? No. So what they had done is they had allowed people to buy on their arrival a lamb or whatever they were going to offer as a sacrifice. So that's why you have all the cattle here at the temple, so that people could come and buy what they needed to make the sacrifice. Anybody know what's going on with coins?
It's different currencies.
Yes. And evidently, I'm standing on the shoulders of the historians here too, okay? I just read what people said about it. You had to have temple currency to pay the temple tax, right? And so you would have to exchange money in order to get the money in order to pay the tax. Now, all of those were appropriate business practices. Those were things that you could do, no problem.
But the key, it was in the temple.
Okay, y'all gotta let me ask the question. Because the next thing I was gonna ask was, if it's okay to come and buy my sheep to sacrifice, and if I've gotta change my local currency to deal with the temple, what's the problem? Yes, sir.
Well, weren't there also tiers to the sacrifice
that
they would do? Like there's discussion about, you know, the very, very poor can only buy doves or things like that. So this is the highest echelon of expense that somebody is saving for the last minute out of convenience.
Right. Yeah, it would depend on your wealth as to what kind of animal
so it's not,
you were required to offer.
Yeah, those people could probably have done it or hired somebody to help them get this to Jerusalem, but they're just showing up and doing it.
You know, from what I read about that, there wasn't an indication that the Lord is unhappy that they're buying the cattle when they get there. We'll dig into a little more of that, and y'all can see if you buy this. Now, you brought up something, Robert. What was the thing that you said?
It was taking place in the temple.
Okay. So one of the problems is with the where. The Old Testament, the New Testament temple, here's a kind of a drawing of it. Was a huge complex, okay? What we typically think of as the temple with the altar and the holy place and the most holy place, that's that innermost section. Do you see that kind of that inner rectangle with the tall gold thing on top and all that? That's where you would have had the holy place and the most holy place and the altar and all of that. Only a Jew could go in there, okay? In fact, you can kind of see a perimeter around that, and there would be signposted at the entrance to that perimeter is about Gentiles. And if they were to enter, the punishment was, anybody know?
Okay.
Yeah, you died. If you were a Gentile and you went in there. In fact, there's a story about that in Acts. Anybody remember this? When Paul came back to Jerusalem, he had a Gentile with him named Trophimus. And someone accused him of taking Trophimus into the temple, not the court, but into that inner sanctuary. And that's when the riot broke out and they arrested him and nearly killed him. Right? So, no Gentile could go in there, but Gentiles could go into the courts. You see where the label is? Court of the Gentiles, that big open area. Gentiles could go in there. And that's where all this business was being transacted.
I have a question real quick. Even after Jesus died, the Gentiles still couldn't go into the temple?
Well, remember, not too long after Jesus died, the temple didn't exist anymore. Okay. But yes, the Jews would still not have let them in. They were still practicing Judaism. Yes, sir?
So I went back just to read a little bit about the law in relationship to the Passover. And the interesting thing that was brought up was what I think maybe Jesus was after here. When Moses gave the command to do this Passover feast, he told the people to go out and select a lamb and get it prepared. And when he got through the whole speech, the people went out and did that. There was a lot of preparation that took place at the Passover.
Yeah.
A lot of it. There were rules and there were laws that governed everything. And for Jesus to get as angry as he got about this, the fact that there were cattle in the courtyard, I don't really think that probably was it. Because when you look deeper at what Jesus was always looking at, what's in your heart? What are you doing? And how are you servicing what God told you to do? And I think that that's what got him upset. Yeah, the cattle in the courtyard wasn't a great thing either. But they had given up all of the preparation, all of the thought process that was supposed to go into the Passover of what God did for them when he got them out of Egypt. I think they missed it.
Well, yes. What I want to do is throw in here Matthew's account of this, because in Matthew 21, verse 13, Matthew adds another detail that I think identifies at least another piece, if not the core of the problem, which is related to the heart. When he drives everybody out, in Matthew's account, Jesus says, "Stop making my father's house." Does anybody know how that's been?
A den of robbers.
A den of robbers, right? And so it isn't just that the business is being transacted right here in the middle of the temple. Evidently, there's also some less than honest business practices going on. My guess about that, because it's not explained, it's not unpacked for us, but my guess is, I apologize for what I'm about to say because I'm going to offend you and probably most people in your family. It's like Disney World, right? If you've been to Disney World, when you get off the ride, you exit through the gift shop and you buy an $89 bear on the way out, right? They probably took 28 cents to manufacture.
You can't offend the truth.
Right, yeah, it is true. Absolutely right. We had some visitors here this morning that are on their way over. I mean, they're like trying to drive over to watch the eclipse. And they said they were trying to find a room, and hotels in Fredericksburg are going for $1,500.
Yep.
What?
3 minutes of darkness ain't worth 50 minutes. I'm just not there on that. But that's the kind of idea. It becomes sort of a religious tourist trap. So I think you're right. I don't think it was just that they're doing it right here in my father's house. But remember, Jesus knows more than just what he can see. What else does he know?
The heart.
Yeah, look at the end of chapter 2. Right into chapter 2. He knew himself what was in man. I mean, John says this right here in this chapter. So he can see the thoughts of the coin changers and the people selling the cattle and what they're really there about and taking advantage of the traveler. And so I want you to think about this. That's the scene that he walks into. when he comes into the temple. He's got cattle everywhere and the mess that goes with all of that, and the merchants and the money changers doing their business. But more than that, he knows what they're thinking, who they're going to take advantage of, how they're going to rip these guys off. He knows the materialism that's driving them. And this most sacred place on earth has just been turned into a religious flea market. I think the most important words in this story are three words in verse 16. Will you look there? When he calls them out, he says, "Stop making my Father's house a place of business." I think those are the most important words in this text. My Father's house. I think we forget that to Jesus, this isn't the temple. This is his Father's house. And these men had corrupted. So imagine those of us in the room who have elderly parents. Imagine that one of your siblings who is a derelict moves in with your mom and dad, starts dealing drugs out of their living room, brings all his buddies over to party in their house, and they tear up the house. What are you going to do to your beat-up brother?
Before or after the funeral?
What are you going to do? Seriously, what would you do? I would go over and collect his things and him and remove him from the house, right? Very natural, normal impulse. Yeah.
David, so in talking about, I always took this when I read this, this was different than other Passovers. It wasn't like this was a common practice for these folks to be doing this stuff. I just want to know, is that an error from what you have studied and read, or is that correct? Because I can't believe that Jesus saw this year after year and never corrected them.
That is such a difficult question to answer, Robert, in part because there are accounts of this that come early in Jesus' story, and there are accounts of this that come late in the stories, and you've got to decide, do you believe that this happened on two different occasions, which there are some believe that's the case, or is it all one occasion, it just pops up at different places in the gospel, and I'm happy for you to try to untangle that one and make a decision about it.
This one was different in the past.
I do not get the sense.
This was over the top.
Well, okay, what's the response of the authorities?
The question.
Yeah, who are you to do this? And I don't get the sense that it is unusual. And especially if it happens twice during the three-year ministry of Jesus, that would evidently indicate that it wasn't unusual at all. That, in fact, after he cleans up, it goes right back to where it was. Right. All I would say is that I think that Jesus' actions here are perfectly reasonable. I think sometimes we don't appreciate how utterly chaotic the scene he created was. I mean, it's not like he told 12 people to leave. I mean, he makes a whip, and the first thing he does is move the cattle through what?
The people.
A crowd of thousands upon thousands. I've been to a couple of postseason games at Minute Maid. I gotta tell you, when you're leaving, you can relate to this, and you get in one of those concourses. So I'm a tad claustrophobic. I do not like it, because it looks like this, trying to get out of that place. Everyone's all mushed together. I get the sense that's what's going on in this courtyard, is everybody's milling around trying to get their purchases done so they could do their business, and all of a sudden, the cattle start moving. And I'm thinking when the cattle move, you get out of the way, right? Right? And so then in the middle of all of that, Jesus starts upending the tables, and what happens to the coins?
They go everywhere.
Boom, they go everywhere. And what's everyone doing when the coins fall?
Grabbing the coins up.
Every teenage boy is on his knees, right? I gotta give me some of that. And what are the coin guys doing?
No,
that's my, can you imagine the chaos? I mean, this wasn't some little happening. This was, Jesus created a scene here. In fact, so much so, don't miss 2 in verse 18. That's why I went on down and read a little bit more and gave you this part. The authorities come in, and what do they want to know?
What gives you the right?
What gives you the right to come in here and do this? And his response is interesting, isn't it? What does he say?
Destroy the temple and I'll raise it in 3 days.
Destroy the temple in 3 days and I'll rebuild it. Don't you know that must have been just an utterly bizarre answer to that? What? Why did he say that, by the way? What was he talking about?
Talking about his death.
His resurrection. That's exactly right. He's talking about him, which, by the way, is going to be the key proof that he is who?
The Messiah.
Son of God.
Son of God. Cleaning up daddy's house that you guys have made a mess of. Right. So the critical question I think people have about this story is, and this is where I'm going to let you get back in where you started to go, was his response appropriate? Because I think some people read the story and what they imagine is that Jesus kind of flew off the handle. He went in and, well, I mean, how would you feel walking into your parents' home with your drug-addicted brother turning it into a drug house? How would you react? Oh, I'd be furious. I don't have any brothers, so this is a problem for me. And I don't think any of my sisters are going to become drug dealers, but we'd be furious, right? You think you could lose your temper in that situation?
Yes.
Oh, I think he's going out through a window, right? Yeah, not the door. We're going to start flinging stuff out there. I could totally see losing my cool. Here's the thing I want you to understand. I think that's what people think Jesus does here. He just goes in there, he's furious, and he just loses it. And that's why they don't like the story. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say that it's interesting the way that the apostles responded. They weren't like, what in the world? They were like remembering a prophecy.
A zeal for my Father's house consumed. So what do you think of his reaction here? Is it appropriate? So first of all, do you think he flies off the handle?
No.
Yeah, a lot of y'all brought that up at the beginning. Y'all were so quick to come to Jesus' defense early. Good for you. I don't think he flies off the handle either. Jesus always blends responses with a perfect level of righteousness and justice and love and mercy. Always. Always a perfect blend. Okay? Same thing going on here. I think our bigger problem is that we're not comfortable with Jesus being angry because this is what we're used to seeing on the refrigerator door. The picture on the left, not the picture on the right. So let's explore that a little bit. Are you surprised to see Jesus angry?
No. Mm-hmm.
Why not?
He's his father's son.
Yeah.
Apple don't fall far from the tree, as they say. No, but seriously, if you think about it, I mean, the Lord destroyed cities. He destroyed lives. He destroyed prophets. We've been reading about the prophets, and he let a prophet get eaten or mauled by a lion. I mean, that's terrible.
I think we forget we're dealing with the divine Son of God. We're dealing with God in the flesh, and anybody who doesn't think God gets angry and brings terrible judgments hasn't read their Bible, right?
Same people that think that God would, like, we would never be sent to hell for whatever, right? There's the people who are uncomfortable with this image.
It's the whole thing. We don't like any of it.
We don't like that.
Judgment and hell. I'm giving myself a little coverage for this morning. Judgment and hell have disappeared from American pulpits. Go to churches all over the country, never hear anything like that. In fact, heard one preacher say, my people would be shocked if I got up and talked about hell for them. So if you go back, for example, go back to 2 Kings 17 for just a moment. I don't want to just say this. I want you to see this. In 2 Kings 17, this is at the end of Judah. No, I'm sorry, the end of Israel. And in chapter 17 of 2 Kings, God's talking about why they failed. And if you get like around verse 7, he talks about how they feared other gods, verse 7, and they walked in the custom of other nations. Verse 9, they built high places. Verse 10, sacred pillars, burned incense, served idols, on and on and on. Verse 13, I sent them prophets, they didn't listen, they rejected my covenant. 17 of 70, it's kind of the worst of the worst. They made their children to pass through fire. What is that?
Child
sacrifice, the worst of the pagan practices. But look at 18. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah. And so God literally brought the awful Assyrians. He raised them up, used them to quote the prophet's language as the rod of his anger to destroy the northern kingdom, to send in the armies, to wipe out the cities, to haul the people off into captivity. Is that sort of an unusual moment in the Bible story? Is what we read here unusual?
Nope. Happens again and again.
This is the Old Testament Bible story about God's people rebellious and him bringing judgment and punishing them for their sins over and over again. And so to get to this story and to act like it's strange is just if anything, the response of Jesus here is measured. Why not just call down fire from heaven and consume the court? Could he have done that? Would that have been inconsistent with other biblical behavior? Absolutely not.
Less drastic than the flood.
How far back you want to go in the story? So that is the point. I just think people read this story and they don't put it in the broader Bible context. You had your hand up a minute ago, Robert. I'm coming to you next, Richard. Go ahead.
You went there.
Oh, did I? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, the religious world doesn't like a Jesus who is going to be any form of judgment. They want a loving Jesus that accepts everyone. And so when there's some, that's why a lot of them disregard the Old Testament.
Okay.
They just want a loving Savior that takes care of everybody.
But I think part of that too is an inadequate response to imbalance. And I think we can't forget that, because if you went back 200 years ago, hellfire and brimstones were not unusual in sermons. That was the sermon. The goal of a preacher was to dangle his audience over the fires of hell so he could get the response he wanted. And so you got a whole lot of that, not a lot of love and mercy and those kind of ideas. And so let's be clear, that kind of preaching is out of balance. Okay? It gives us only a God of anger and wrath and not a God of love and mercy. Does that make sense? You see the need for balance there? But in trying to correct, what did we do? We made God an indulgent grandpa.
Forgot about Sodom and Gomorrah.
And he's not. That's exactly right. I'm coming over to you, Richard.
Would there be a comparison between this and the people questioning God, why was he with the sinners when he should be with the good people, the good people, and then him showing what he thinks about the sinners in terms of the sinners needing to know, sinners needing to know that they were sinners.
Yes. Yeah. Look, he's calling them out for their sin in this text. That's what's going on. You've corrupted my father's house. And he cleaned it up. And it's calling them to behave themselves. Yes, ma'am.
Jesus is like the master communicator, and he used this whole huge audience, a captive audience, and made it a whole teachable moment for huge.
Think anybody forgot this?
Nope.
you remember that year when we came to Passover? Yeah, I think everyone remembers that. All right, I want to do one more thing quick before we run out of time. And that is, we need to know what to do with this. So I was talking about the Christian's responsibility to imitate Jesus, and I had this smart aleck college kid in class who said, yeah, what do you do with this story in John 2? How are we supposed to imitate that? So yeah, y'all have fun with that. Tell me the answer. How do we imitate Jesus in this?
We maintain our self-control in our moment of anger.
Certainly he did. I buy that. I think that's a good lesson.
So anger is an emotion that God gave all of us. And it's there for a reason. And in Ephesians 4 and in Psalms, you can go back and you can look, you know, be angry and sin not. So what does that tell me? That tells me there is a right place and a right time for anger to take place, but be very careful because that's an emotional response that could lead you into trouble very quickly.
Yeah, so let's say that first, because I think sometimes we are so worried about behaving badly when we're angry that we've almost made anger the problem. It's kind of like making money the problem when the problem is really
the love of money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so anger is not the problem. God made us with the capacity to get angry. What Paul tells us in Ephesians 4:26 is be angry and
sin not.
Yeah, don't sin, okay? In fact, I want to push that further. I think that we ought to be more angry than we are sometimes. Do you buy that? One of the concerns I have is that we've lost the capacity to get angry. I think we need to be more angry about the kind of things that Jesus was angry about. Now, see, I'm getting started to warm up to what you were saying earlier. I think we're surrounded by people who've corrupted God's church. I could preach a lesson on how I think the church has been, God's stuff. I think people have corrupted his church as an example of that, made it into something that he didn't intend. They've corrupted his message, made it what they wanted it to be rather than what he wanted it to be. I think we need to be angry about that.
Corrupting the rainbow. That's a big deal, and I don't think sometimes we're not angry enough about that.
I think we need to be angry about the progress of sin in our culture. Guys, sin is on the march. I get particularly upset about homosexuality and transgenderism, not because they're just particularly awful sins, but because they mark just exceptionally high levels of degradation. We have forgotten what it means to be a human being. We don't even know what a man or woman is anymore. That is fundamental corrupted thinking. And I'm most concerned about Satan's victories among us. I just taught a class for parents with prodigal kids, and we filled this room with parents who have prodigal children. Satan is picking off our kids. Are y'all mad about that? I think we need to be outraged that that's happened. At the average church is losing 60 or 70% of their kids. And I don't sense the anger. I think the devil has lulled us into a state of indifference, and terrible things are happening to us all around us, and the enemy has all these advantages, and we're just sort of standing there on the sidelines. And I will tell you that I think indifference is the middle ground that we pass through before we get to acceptance. And so the point that I want to make about that is I think this story is a great example from which to learn the lesson. There's a time and a place to be angry. Why did God give us that ability to get mad?
To correct things.
Anger makes you do something, right? And that's what Jesus does here. He's mad and he moves, he acts. Our ability to get mad is a driver to act, not with sin, but to act nonetheless. And so that's the thought I would leave you with this little picture of Jesus. Think about the story where Jesus got mad and he cleaned house. God's people need to learn to be mad about the right stuff again. Do something about it. I'll leave you out with that. Thank you.
I think you're also afraid to get back.